In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with holistic sleep coach Morgan Adams, who helps Gen X and millennial women sleep better and heal their insomnia. Morgan and I speak about reasons for waking up at 3 a.m., what to do about it, the worst thing you could possibly do if waking up, and should you be taking any sleep supplements? I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Morgan, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now, on to my conversation with Morgan. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with holistic sleep coach Morgan Adams. Morgan helps Gen X and millennial women sleep better and heal from insomnia. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you.
I'm super excited to talk about all things sleep. I've had my own issues with sleep over the let's say last decade or longer, but we'll probably touch on some of that. But I don't even want to start off with that. I would love to hear more about you to begin with, simply hearing how you got to what you do today and where you are today.
Sure. Well, my sleep story started, 20 years ago, maybe. I had what they call sleep onset insomnia. Basically a fancy way of saying I had a really hard time falling asleep. And this got kicked off by just a relationship challenge in my romantic life. And after about 2 months of not being able to fall asleep for 1 or 2 hours, I went to my doctor and I said, hey, I'm having trouble sleeping. And I was given a prescription for a sleeping pill called Ambien. And I'm sure most people listening have heard of it. At the time of this whole thing with the relationship shakeup, I was a pharmaceutical sales rep. And so I was in the world of medications and pills and all that stuff. So when a doctor said, okay, you can take this pill to sleep, I thought, no big deal. Like it was just a non-thing for me. So I took the pill and I fell asleep faster as advertised. But I had a lot of residual side effects the next day, grogginess, brain fog, trouble concentrating. And at this point, I'd already kind of switched careers to a career where I was in PR and I had to write very fast on a deadline and remember getting into trouble several times because I could not produce my work quickly enough because I was so groggy, brain fogged from the medication residual. Around this time, I started dating a new guy who said to me in a very loving way, Morgan, when you take those sleeping pills, you sort of turn into a zombie and it freaks me out. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's right. You know, like these pills are no longer really serving me. So I made the decision to stop taking the pills. And I did what I do not recommend other people do, and that is just go off of them by yourself without the guidance of your providing practitioner or your prescribing practitioner. Luckily for me, I was able to kind of weather the storm and get through it with grit. And again, you know, just to point it out again, if you are on any medication, just please consult your provider in helping you get off the medication. Well, I got off the medication fine. Slept pretty well for many years. And then there was a plot twist. That was March of 2020. If we think back to that time, beginning of the pandemic, nobody knew what was going on. There was a lot of confusion and my sleep started to suffer at that point. And I got very concerned because I did not want to go down the road of insomnia. So I bought myself an Oura ring to track my sleep. I started to Google how to get better sleep. And I was able to quickly get my sleep back on track, fortunately. And during this time, I started to share on Facebook what I was doing to improve my sleep. And I found out that a lot of other women in my social circle were having trouble sleeping too. And so it got me thinking, okay, there are a lot of women out there who are struggling with sleep. I seem to have figured it out at this point. Why not make this an actual business, because there seems to be some kind of interest. So that realization happened in late 2020. And of course, once you declare that you want to do something, well, you kind of have to figure out how to do it, right? You can't just, hang up a shingle and say, I'm a sleep coach now. Hello. So I spent a year doing health coach certifications, sleep coaching certifications, immersed in, the topics of sleep and health, and then launched this practice in 2021. And it has been an absolute joy to help women sleep better, heal their insomnia, and live healthier, more fulfilling lives.
Wonderful. And I really think that most coaches or most successful coaches have struggled with a certain problem themselves. And then just by overcoming that and learning more about it, that makes them such a great coach now, because you can truly relate to what your clients go through. So thank you for sharing that. And for me, it was never an issue like falling asleep. It was more from doing shift work for several years that I had completely, quote unquote, broken my circadian rhythm. And prior to that, I had a very, very healthy sleep of like very sound and deep as well. But then after going through these horrible shift rosters type things, I really like on a normal night, I would wake up 6 to 8 times, also caused by my ex-husband snoring at the time and so on. So many things contributing. But yeah, like you, I kind of dove into many of the things of like, okay, what are some of the basics? And most of the listeners will know, because I speak about several basics so regularly, like setting a set time to go to sleep and getting up at the same time, light exposure, and all these kinds of things, and of course nutritional aspects as well, which many of the things I saw you speak about in your content as well, which I loved. And one of the things that still I'm asked about quite a lot, and that spoke to me in one of your posts, was why do many people wake up between the hours of like 3 or 4 a.m. and then sometimes either not able to go back to sleep, or staying up for like an hour and then going back to sleep? What is it about that wicked hour?
Yeah. Well, you've touched on a very, very important question. And it's the question I get asked most by my clients. And it's the problem that they come to me most often with. And so I created a free guide called Awake Again at 3 a.m., your guide to why you wake up and what to do about it. And so that is a free asset on my website. People can go get it. And I would suggest doing it. But let's hit on a few of the key highlights from that guide. First thing I'll share is that it is actually very normal for us to wake up in the middle of the night. And the reason why is because after every sleep cycle, of which we have about 5 to 7 throughout the night, we may have a brief awakening after each sleep cycle. Now, the evolutionary reason or theory for this is that if you think back to many, many years ago, when we were out on the savannah, we didn't have these nice protected homes with security systems. We were vulnerable to prey, right? So we needed to kind of keep alert. So that wake up is sort of a throwback to the brief scanning that we do once we wake up. Now, if you're awake for like less than 2 minutes, you're probably not going to remember that awakening. But the problem is when we are awake longer and we can't get back to sleep. And so what we often find is this kind of phenomena called mind after midnight. And it's a topic that's being studied a lot more lately. And we find that our thoughts are quite irrational in the middle of the night. They can be catastrophic, right? And that is because we are not operating from the rational side of our brain, our prefrontal cortex. We're more kind of focused on the amygdala side of our brain working. So I think it's really important that when we wake up at night and we are having these negative catastrophic thoughts, that we actually realize that that's normal too, right? And so kind of making a contract with ourself, don't believe any of these thoughts, don't act on any of these thoughts, because what you will find is that the next morning when you're reflecting, you're going to say to yourself, I can't really believe I thought that at that time of night when I woke up. You can say to yourself in the moment while you're awake, hey, and say your name personally, because that kind of gives you a little bit of distance. could say to yourself, Lisa, you know, what are you going to think of the situation in 1 year or 10 years to give you that psychological distance, right? So that's a strategy that I would employ if I was waking up and started having catastrophic thoughts. But let's really quickly touch on a couple of reasons other than the natural awakening after the sleep cycle. And these are detailed in the guide, but a few of the main culprits of the awakenings. Number one is we get too hot, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're having a hot flash or a night sweat, but we just generally could be overheated. And so some solutions to that are just cooling your bedroom environment more, lowering the temperature a couple of degrees. Having cooling bedding and sleepwear is a great thing. And then there's the next level solution of cooling mattress toppers. Those are great as well. And then one of the second reason quite often is blood sugar imbalances. So what we will see happen to a lot of people at 2 or 3 a.m. is this blood sugar crash, right? And that stimulates this cortisol and adrenaline response that wakes us up sort of in kind of an alert state. And one of the things we can do to mitigate that, if we think that's what it is have a very small snack about an hour before bed. And the small snack would be, you know, some protein, some fat, maybe a Greek yogurt with some nuts, or maybe half a banana with some almond butter. And that could potentially stave off the middle of the night wakeups if you've got that blood sugar dysregulation going on. That's really kind of a quick fix. If someone is experiencing that and, you know, you do find you're waking up because of the blood sugar crash, you're going to want to take a deeper dive into your blood sugar overall and manage that on a more holistic level. And then the third reason, and this is one of the reasons that it's the most shocking to people, but it's sleep breathing issues like sleep apnea or upper airway resistance syndrome. And what we know is that 90% of women who have sleep apnea go undiagnosed. It's crazy. It's a crazy statistic. So quite often we may think about somebody who has sleep apnea in our heads as this kind of overweight, middle-aged guy snoring on a couch or their bed. And the reality is that when women become in midlife age range, our sleep apnea rates pretty much match those of our male counterparts. I've had many clients through the years have sleep apnea. They've either had it and known it and come to me because they also had insomnia, or while we're working together and we find that the interventions aren't working as well, I suggest that they get a sleep study, right? And you would be shocked at how many women in their 30s who are thin, middle-aged women who are fit and healthy, don't have a big neck. These women are being diagnosed with mild apnea. And so the mild apnea essentially can create these micro awakenings during the night. And the result is that you don't feel rested in the morning, even though you've had like your 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So if you had a sleep tracker, for example, and you looked at your data, and you saw lots of little small awakenings throughout the night, to me, that would be a very good sign that you need to get your sleep breathing looked at. And a sleep study is really the thing that you'd want to do to look at it. A sleep tracking ring or a watch isn't really going to give you the accurate data that you would need to get the proper diagnosis. So fortunately, in this day and age, post-COVID, what we're able to get are sleep studies sent to our house. Now, you can go in a lab, and that's the gold standard in accuracy. You're going to get a really accurate reading, but not everyone is going to want to go to a lab, right? And get those things hooked up to them. So you can have a sleep study, a sleep test sent to your house, and you can get the results in like 48 hours. It's really nice. So I would definitely, and also, you know, you mentioned your snoring ex-husband. I had one of those too, by the way, former life. And if your spouse or partner is snoring, definitely a sign that they need to get a sleep study. So yeah, so that's really kind of the general kind of take home from about the 3 a.m. awakenings. My free guide goes into more detail, but I think that's a really good starting point.
That's awesome. And I will most certainly link that free guide or the website in the show notes as well. Speaking of the insomnia, because I actually, or the apnea, I'm totally blown by this data. And funnily enough, I was speaking with my mentor yesterday, and he was like, "Oh, Lisa, have you had any sleep experts on?" And I said, "Oh, well, actually, as a matter of fact, I'm interviewing someone tomorrow. Why is that?" And he said, "Well, I'm curious about sleep apnea. Is there any alternate treatments other than a CPAP, other than a sleep breathing machine?" So that's my question to you. Is something like mouth taping, or like what kind of more quote unquote natural ways would we have to treat apnea?
Yeah, so the CPAP is what people most commonly think of when they think of sleep apnea treatment. It's sort of the gold standard, but with in the whole sleep field right now, the most activity happening in terms of developments and treatments is in sleep apnea. And so this is not really my area of expertise, sleep apnea. I usually refer out to deal with this, but there are things like oral appliances that are just kind of like, plastic. It's just, they go in your mouth and then you get them adjusted over time, helps open up your airway. There's also devices. There's one in particular called Excite OSA. And that's sort of like a tongue trainer that you wear for 20 minutes a day to help you with the physical part of the sleep apnea. The mouth tape is an interesting one. So you want to make sure that you talk to your doctor about mouth tape. It can help reduce snoring for people, but if you have untreated sleep apnea, what they are finding is that they could exacerbate it, right? Because you need to, if you're going to tape your mouth, you need to actually ensure that you're able to breathe through your nose, right? That would be a really bad situation if you found out you couldn't breathe through your nose while you had the mouth tape on. So if anyone is thinking about mouth taping, get evaluated. I mean, I've been using mouth tape for like 3 years. I started off using it. I knew that I needed to see if I could breathe through my nose. So what I did was I just used it during the day for a couple hours while I was working, and I was able to breathe through my nose. And that was like, okay, you can do this. Why don't you try it at night? So just, it's not a one size fits all for everybody. I feel like, I mean, I love the mouth tape, but I feel like it's somewhat, it's kind of gotten to be a trend, on TikTok and whatnot. And it's just sort of thrown around willy nilly. Like, we really can't just use it on everybody. Like, so beware, get screened before you really commit to the mouth tape.
Awesome. Yeah, I like that caution note there. And as you said, it's just something that pops up on social media quite a lot. So thank you for those tips. I have one further question in regards to the, or actually two, in regards to the 3 a.m. wake up. And that regard, it refers more to hormones, because I believe that that can sometimes also be a reason why people wake up in the middle of the night. What kind of connection is there between the hormones and our or could there
Yeah.
mean that?
Well, sometimes what we might see is because of our stress and our worry, we might have a little bit of a cortisol bump in the middle of the night, and that could wake us up. So in that case, I would say managing your stress, like doing some deep breathing, not only before bed, but doing that during the day, managing your stress during the day and reducing your stress day and night. So to mitigate that cortisol kind of wake up. Then we have the whole, menopausal types of hormonal flux, estrogens declining, progesterones declining. And, one of the ways you can deal with that is exploring hormone replacement therapy, right? Those tend to be pretty reliable solutions for things like hot flashes and night sweats, because if you're getting those, your sleep is definitely disturbed, right? We know that with estrogen declining, that estrogen is affecting your serotonin production, which is affecting your melatonin production. with progesterone, that is actually working with your GABA receptors. So the progesterone supplementation can help sort of give you a little bit more calm and ease, right? It kind of acts almost like the way a magnesium would, working on similar receptors. So those are things to consider if you are in perimenopause or menopause and you're having sleep challenges. Just have a discussion with your doctor, to see if, HRT is like a solution for you.
Thank you. And yeah, the second question that I still had was, so when we do wake up in the middle of the night, and that kind of goes back to one of the posts that I saw on your content as well. What is something we should absolutely not do? I mean, there are some theories about like you should count sheep, you should read a really boring research paper. Like, what's something you should definitely not do?
Yeah, well, there are a few that come to mind. Number one, I wouldn't look at the clock. What we find a lot is that when you look at the clock in the middle of the night, you tend to do this, what I call sleep math. So, like, let's just say that you wake up at 3, your alarm's going off at 6, and you're like, oh crap, I've got like 3 hours more of sleep. That just creates this exacerbated, situation in your head, and you're more anxious. The more anxious you are, the harder it is to get to sleep. So I would really, urge people to take that into consideration and not have a clock in your bedroom. Or if you have a clock, turn it around so that it's not visible to you while you're in bed, right? So that's one thing. Second thing I would not do is I would not grab your phone and start scrolling, right? Now, there are going to be a certain segment of people for whom this is going to be okay, right? But I think for the majority of the population, it's kind of a recipe for becoming more engaged and more awake, right? Because you've got a couple things happening. You've got the blue light from the screen that's shining on you. You've also potentially got content because people tend to scroll social media when they, get on a phone at night, and the scrolling part is activating to your brain. So you want to, really kind of avoid picking up your phone if possible. And now there are some exceptions to that too, as well. Like when I'm working with clients who want something to do at night when they wake up that's going to be calming, well, they may do a breath work or a meditation app. And in that case, okay, maybe put on some blue blocking glasses, maybe, start your meditation or whatever and put the phone across the room so that you're not staring at it. And then the other thing that I would probably avoid doing would be eating. So we talked about that little snack before bed if you're having blood sugar issues. That's a specific a use case scenario there. But sometimes what people will do is they will wake up and they're maybe bored and they decide to have a snack. I would discourage people from doing this because from a circadian perspective, when you eat, it activates your pancreas. And once your pancreas gets activated, your melatonin production shuts down. So you're really kind of giving yourself the opposite signals of sleep because you want that melatonin happening, getting produced at night and secreted at night. And you can also, this is interesting, you can almost train yourself to wake up for a snack, right? Because you expect it. So I would really, really urge people to like not do the snacking thing if they wake up in the middle of the night. So those are a few things off the top of my head that I would say pause on doing those things.
Really great pointers. And like generally speaking, I am a big advocate for keeping the phone out of the bedroom if possible. Like not even having it in reach within reach because we're so like tempted. Oh, I'll just check quickly before you go to bed or in the morning first thing. So overall, I'm just such a big fan of not having the phone in the bedroom. But yeah, in regards to the food you were saying, it interferes with melatonin production. And melatonin was actually one other thing I wanted to ask you about because in the past, like many years ago, I just thought like, oh, okay, melatonin is in many sleep supplements. I'll just take it regularly because it's also an antioxidant and blah blah blah. And then a little while later, I learned more about it, and now I personally discourage people from taking melatonin on a regular basis, especially in high doses, as it's usually sold. But yeah, I'm curious about your opinion on melatonin supplementation and also just any other kind of supplements that you sometimes recommend for aiding with sleep.
Yeah. So melatonin is one of those very controversial topics in sleep. There's a lot of a divisiveness about it. I tend to be on the side that's a little bit more pro-melatonin, but there's some caveats to it. So melatonin has historically been used pretty successfully for jet lag, shift work, circadian rhythm disorders. So that's a commonly used, that's a common use for melatonin. Now, in my opinion, I do believe there is somewhat of a use case for people having it once they are in their 50s and beyond. The reason I say this is because we know that there's actually a decline in melatonin as we age. And so you could look at it as supplementing what you've lost, similar to the way that we just talked about HRT. You're supplementing what you've lost. So I do think there's a good use case for that in your midlife years. But there are some caveats to the melatonin conversation, and you really want to make sure that you're sourcing your melatonin in a good way. So years ago, they did a study where they pulled melatonin bottles off the shelves from pharmacies and grocery stores in Canada to see if the melatonin advertised on the outside of the bottle matched what was in the actual pill. And they found a very wide variance between what was advertised on the bottle and what was actually in the pill. So there was like some melatonins had less, and then some had up to like 478% more melatonin than was advertised. And so, you're not going to like have a massive side effect from melatonin. It's not going to hurt you significantly, but we know that some people may have grogginess the next day from too much melatonin. So no one wants to be groggy in the morning, right? So if you're going to experiment with melatonin, I would say make sure that the source is like a pharmaceutical grade. There's also a product that I use myself and recommend called Herbitonin. It's a plant melatonin made with just alfalfa, chlorella, and rice. It's actually been shown to be more effective from the antioxidant and anti-inflammatory aspect of melatonin than synthetic melatonin. And then a lot of synthetic melatonin brands have added ingredients that may not be as healthy. So those are things to keep in mind. Now, I did just last week hear about a really interesting study on melatonin dosing and timing. So this was compiling a lot of different, it's a meta-analysis, so it's compiling a lot of different studies. And they were saying that, and this kind of surprised me a little bit, that the ideal timing and dose was having 4 milligrams of melatonin 3 hours before bed. Right. Now, I
Yes.
knew that dosing melatonin was really best, a couple hours before bed. A lot of directions on melatonin bottles will say at bed or 3 or 30 minutes before bed. And I did understand that melatonin was to be dosed usually for a normal sleeper a couple hours before bed, but 3 hours seemed like a lot. And then 4 milligrams of melatonin seemed kind of like a lot, but I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where, not medical advice, but maybe it's worth experimenting. Maybe if you are on melatonin and you want to keep taking it, but you're not really getting the benefits, play around with the dose or the timing, right? One of the things though that I'll end the conversation on the melatonin because it could get long, but one of the things that's a myth out there about melatonin that I think it's important to clear up is that we don't have any evidence at this point from any research that supplementing with melatonin actually impedes your own melatonin production, right? We don't have any evidence of that. So people, shouldn't be scared. Like it shouldn't be a scary thing to supplement with the melatonin in fear that you're not going to create your own, because you still will create your own. But, on a fundamental level, I think what we should all be focusing on more than the supplement conversation is like, how do we produce our own melatonin? Like, how do we enhance that? And really, the best way to do that is by managing our light environment, right? So we really want to make sure that we're getting plenty of daylight in the, during the day, little bursts or like little snacks of natural light during the day, so that we're getting, and this is going to sound like a lot, but 60 minutes of mel of 60 minutes of melatonin, 60 minutes of natural light exposure a day, right, is really like the sweet spot in terms of enhancing your own intrinsic melatonin production. And then on the other side, we want to make sure that we're getting adequate darkness at night, right? We're turning down our light stem. We are, wearing blue blockers if we need to, and so that we're not just surrounded by light at night. It's not when we're supposed to be surrounded by light.
All right. Yes. No problem. And Morgan is just gonna go and let her dog in, but I'm gonna talk a little bit here about my own experience or my own opinions on melatonin as well. So as I was saying, I used to take melatonin quite regularly, also in a high dose, like 5 to 10 grams, I believe. And then I learned that our natural amount of melatonin in on a good day is actually more like 5, or like a tenth of what we should be taking, or what is often commonly sold. So you might be taking your 5 milligrams, whereas your body's natural production is actually 0.5 milligrams. So this high dose, while she's absolutely correct in my opinion with the fact that it's not going to interfere with your own production, I have also heard that it might interfere with the hormone production of other hormones if taken consistently. But going back to the light point, I think that that's such a really great applicable takeaway in the sense of action steps. So getting daylight exposure, and as far as I'm aware, especially that morning light and that evening light, like if we're able to go outside somewhere around about the sunrise time or within an hour or two after that. Of course, with seasons always a little more challenging, or in the evening, that kind of like different light spectrum, that's particularly beneficial for our eyes to view the red lights in the sun. And also doing that without our sunglasses, like while of course not looking into bright sunlight, but in the morning, sun has just come up, and absolutely like looking into that light, as long as it's not painful, not ever looking into the sun in a way that it's painful. At least those are some of the pointers that I have learned.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Well, welcome
Perfect. Yeah,
back.
perfect. I know. I jumped right in, and you're like already speaking beautifully about the light. Yeah, you mentioned the sunglasses. I see people walking around my neighborhood every morning while I'm out walking my dogs with sunglasses on, and it's not even sunny. And the reason why people are like, why can't you wear your sunglasses? The reason is because when the natural light hits your retina, it sends a signal to your suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is your circadian pacemaker. And from there, there's this beautiful trigger of neurotransmitters and hormones. So it like will shut down any residual melatonin. It'll boost your cortisol naturally. And it can even help your thyroid. It can help with your just mood and focus. So many beautiful benefits coming out of that morning light. So when you're wearing your sunglasses, you're basically depriving yourself of all those benefits. Why would you want to do that? But again, just there is some nuance there with sunglasses, because if you're driving to work in the morning and you've heard this episode and you're like, well, I should take my sunglasses off. Well, you want to be safe, right? If there's a glare while you're driving and you can't see, well, you want your sunglasses because you don't want to crash into anything. So just kind of take a common sense approach with the sunglasses. And, you can, I've got very light eyes. And I mean, I used to wear sunglasses 24/7, practically, like every time I stepped out of the house. It was, unless it was night, I would wear sunglasses. And what I found was that it was kind of painful at first to wean myself off, but my eyes have, your eyes become kind of adapted to the light, so that at this point, the only time I'm wearing sunglasses is if, like I said, there's a glare while driving, or if I'm at the pool or a beach and it's just like the middle of the day, like you need to, have a little something on your covering your eyes because it can be insanely bright.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think actually, and yeah, I mean, I think we think the same way about like our skin, a little bit of natural sunlight exposure in the morning and in the evening. That's actually, we've learned that that's quite healthy, but during the day, you don't want to get burned. But yeah, I guess further expanding on the potential supplementations, are there other things? You mentioned magnesium earlier or something of the like are there other natural supplements that you work with your clients?
Well, I'm not like a huge I don't like always recommend supplements to my clients because I really want them to be able to use behavioral strategies to help them sleep. Where I'm finding myself recommending supplements most often is when I have a client who is on a sleep medication and I'm helping them wean off, but to give them almost like this kind of psychological replacement, we will often use a supplement instead of the medication. Now, quite often that can be a placebo, right? Because we don't know how well the supplements work. I mean, it's a tricky area because there is some data showing efficacy with, magnesium, valerian root, chamomile, GABA, L-theanine. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I think that most of these supplements could potentially boost our sleep a little bit. But if we have like real insomnia that is rooted in anxiety and all of that, then the consensus is that a supplement isn't going to cut it, right? Because if you think about it, like we would have hardly any people with insomnia if supplements worked, because most people who have insomnia take a supplement, right? Yet they're still calling me for help, or they're still going to their doctor. So I just feel like your mileage may vary with supplements. I take a supplement myself, and that it has a blend of many, many different things in it. It's more of like a sleep wellness supplement, but it's also like a hot cocoa mix. And so for me, I'm like, it's kind of my ritual. Like, it's sort of like, okay, this is signaling to my body and brain, we're going into downshift mode. We're having a nice little treat because I love some chocolate, but I don't want to have a chocolate bar at 8 at night, right? So, I think that the supplements like that could have a place in cueing you for the transition into the evening time. But I wouldn't be like, this has got to work. Like, you don't want to have too much psychological reliance on like this better work. You just have to kind of, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But there is a lot of placebo effect with a supplement, I believe.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I love what you say about that shift down routine, and which is such a big part of quote unquote sleep training, right? Like just like we I often say to clients when they are struggling with sleep, to treat yourself a little bit like a child, because we can't just expect like you're going from work, 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 and then we want to hit the switch and like okay, suddenly you're out. If you're a ch like children like having a set bedtime, children like having a story read to them, children like knowing what's coming up, and you brush your teeth, and that's like initiating that process. And so having that routine for yourself as well, where you're like, okay, I want to be asleep by 10, so that means at 9 I should start winding down. That means ideally I should stop working at 8, and like just having those set routines and it, potentially a cocoa or whatever within that is a wonderful practice, I believe.
Yeah, and I think you said it so great. Treat yourself like a toddler, right? We really need to really hone in on some kind of evening routine that works for us, because Matthew Walker, a really famous sleep scientist, talks about the sleep is sort of like landing a plane. You have to gradually descend into it. You can't have a crash landing, because our bodies and brains just aren't adapted to that. So if you can carve out like at least a half an hour for that wind down, and sometimes you may have to put an alert on your phone or have some kind of timer to alert you to wind down, because we can get wrapped up in things, especially TV, right? And be like, oh my gosh, it's 10 o'clock. I was supposed to be in bed at 9. Yeah.
No,
So
that's a
yeah.
really good point. Yeah, I love Matt Walker. His book, Why We Sleep, was one of the big teachings for me when it came to like working on my sleep routines. I absolutely love it. But yeah, one thing that I wanted to talk to you about also is you mentioned your Oura Ring earlier, and I mean, there's a ton of other sleep trackers. What sort of value do you see in them, or also potential I don't want to say negative sides of them, but like potential things that might not be very helpful about them.
So I'm in general, I am a fan of sleep trackers, and I think that as time has gone on, they've become more accurate. And if you are the kind of person who wants to optimize your sleep, like if you sleep okay, but you're like, I think I could do better. I think I could do better with my sleep. And you're able to actually take the data that you see on your tracker and apply it in real life with behavioral interventions, then that's a great use case for using a sleep tracker. So, for example, if you notice that on the nights you eat late, you don't sleep as well, your deep sleep isn't as good, you can be like, oh, okay, let's try an experiment. Let's try to eat a little bit earlier and see if your sleep improves. So it's things like that that make them worth it. If you're just wearing it day in, day out, you're not even looking at it or applying any of the teachings, then why bother, right? Now, the people that I don't feel do as well with a sleep tracker are actually most of my clients. They have insomnia, right? And so when you have insomnia, you tend to be a little bit more anxious about your sleep. And looking at the data on a daily basis can make people stressed out about their sleep. If they didn't get enough REM or deep sleep, they may be like, oh no. It can create this scenario called orthosomnia, which is like hyperfixating on sleep data. And it can backfire on a lot of people. So if you've got like that kind of thing going on where you do have insomnia and you're anxious, I would say hold off on a sleep tracker till you can get your sleep recalibrated and then introduce it. There's also sort of what I call the middle ground approach to sleep trackers. And that's where you, instead of looking at it every morning, you look at the data once a week and you pick a day and you like look at the trends of the week and evaluate that way. That way, you're not like so fixated on each day's data. You kind of just have a little bit of psychological distance from it, which I think is a nice approach too.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that. I never thought of it in that way. I used to have an Oura, and precisely for the reason that you mentioned, I actually stopped wearing it after about a year and a half. I still think there's tremendous value to it, even just in the sense of being curious, but I found it was stressing me out more than anything because it was like, yeah, I know I slept poorly last night. You don't need to tell me that by showing me a horrible score and, like something like that. But I generally think for anyone, it can be very helpful just seeing like, do I actually, or how many times do I dip into deep sleep? At what time am I, or why am I so alert at this time? Or how, as you mentioned, like how's a hard training session affecting my sleep? So yeah, all these things can be really, really helpful. And I mean, everyone probably has a poor night's sleep from time to time, even if they are pretty routine with all their practices and so on. So if we have had an occasional bad night's sleep, maybe also due to jet lag or a celebration or so, what is something we can do like more or less immediately afterwards or the day afterwards, in order to mitigate some of those effects?
Yes, that's a great question. And I frankly have occasional nights of bad sleep. People are like, do you just sleep perfect? No, I don't sleep perfect every night. I'm in perimenopause. My sleep over the past couple of years has been changing, right? And so I will share what I do to help me on the days that I don't sleep well. So number one, this won't be surprising. I get out and get as much natural light as I can as early as possible. I find that that's helpful. What I also will do after that is I will have a high protein breakfast. That's another thing that gets me. It's like these little layers of energy that I see as I do them. That's like upgrading me a little bit. And then what I'll do after I've had my high protein breakfast is I'll do a workout. And I might be cussing at my treadmill as I'm walking on it or on my bike as I'm getting on the bike because it's the last thing I want to do. But I do it, and it really they there's data showing that exercise can help mitigate the effects of sleep deprivation. Now, you d don't really need to go as hard, right? You don't need to do like a 60-minute HIIT workout, but if you can just get your body moving for like 20 minutes, it's just going to send, you know, that blood to your brain and give you a little bit more focus. Like if you have to get through your workday, those strategies right there will get me through till lunchtime. And then the lunch will kind of energize me. I'll take another walk. And then if I'm feeling like, oh my gosh, I need to power through, I've got podcast clients in the afternoon, I might take a little 20-minute nap. Those are a great way to restore yourself after a night of sleep loss. You want to just make sure they're short because you don't want to cut into your, you don't want to snack on sleep too late in the day because that can interfere with your drive for sleep when you want to sleep. And then the last thing is, although it may be tempting, don't go to bed earlier than usual. You really want to just keep your normal bedtime and just let that sleep pressure build. And if you do those things, chances are you're going to get back on track the next day. And one of the psychological tricks I play on myself, and it's not really a trick, it's more of a strategy, but when I'm really down and out about a bad night of sleep, what gets me motivated or positive is saying, I'm going to sleep well tonight. Because if you've had a bad night of sleep, what you may notice is that your body is just going to make up for it the next night naturally. So you typically will, I mean, there are exceptions, but you typically will obtain the sleep you need that night after a bad night of sleep because your body wants to just be in more homeostasis. So I just give myself a little pep talk.
Well, and
That's
I love
what I do.
that positive reinforcement, because we're so, like you said, it's so easy to get caught in a cycle of almost being afraid of going to bed. Like, oh no, what if I sleep poorly again tonight and I have this big important presentation tomorrow, and then that anxiety builds and so on. So I love the positive self-talk and all the other tips that you gave. I personally also, like, on a night where I'm a little bit sleep deprived, or more specifically also after travel, I'm like, because I travel quite a bit, so often my sleep is cut short or in a different way because of time zone shifting, I am craving more hydration. And I mean, that might be due to the travel, but even on a regular in the same place, I feel like hydrating more actually helps me stay more energized. I don't know if that's just
N=1. No, that's actually a strategy that I didn't include with my strategy, is I make sure I'm really hydrated in the morning. Another, speaking of liquids, I definitely have my coffee. I have a cup of coffee every morning, but I don't actually have extra coffee. So I just, you know, you may be tempted, but the coffee later in the day will backfire on your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You just want to, whatever kind of caffeine schedule you're on, maintain that caffeine schedule, you know, just keep it as is. Don't add more, because you will probably pay the price for it in terms of having trouble falling asleep that night. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Morgan, you've given us so many wonderful tips. I'm truly appreciative of your time. I'm most certainly going to link all of your details in the show notes, more specifically also your website with that free guide, because I think everybody can benefit from at least a few of your tips. And of course, if people want to work with you, they will know where to find you there as well. But yeah, truly, thank you so much for your time. It's been a true pleasure connecting with you.
Yeah, same here. It's been great to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Morgan. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go. If you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening. And don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.